I'm going to say this because, first of all, it needs to be said, but also because nobody in a position to do anything about it will. This is an idiotic way to run a $19 trillion economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, 18 January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So, here we sit, again, without a federal budget, without government funding beyond the next 30 or so hours, staring a shutdown smack in the face. There was a time when this state of affairs was brushed off as Congress simply kicking the can down the road, that they would come to their senses and be responsible. Those days, however, seem to be gone, and this economy has been reduced to getting by on a never-ending series of four-week budget stopgaps. Stan Collender has forgotten more about the federal budget than most of us are ever going to know. He teaches public policy at Georgetown. Stan, good to have you back on.
Always good to be here, Kai.
So test my premise. Is this any way to run an economy like this?
Not a way to run an economy, a railroad, a government, even a Boy Scout troop. We're 4 months into the fiscal year. We don't have a budget. The agencies and departments that are going to have to spend that budget don't know what they're going to have to spend, whether they're going to have to do increases or decreases or layoffs or increasing employment. It's the worst possible way to manage.
I remember back in the day, President Reagan standing at the podium saying, I am not going to sign another continuing resolution. So this has been going on for a while, the fact that the government does short-term funding. It does seem, though, that it's happening with increasing regularity and ill feelings.
Well, two things. First of all, you're exactly right. That is, it's happening more and more frequently and becomes standard operating procedure as if it's acceptable. And that's because the average person doesn't really care whether the government's operating under a continuing resolution or a real appropriation bill. But I want you to keep this in mind, how long this has been going on. The Congressional Budget Act of 1974 was passed in part to prevent continuing resolutions.
So how come we still have them?
We're in a different world now than we were 50 some odd or 40 some odd years ago. We're hyper partisanship. You know, nobody wants to make a difficult decision. It's a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. And on top of everything else, in Washington these days, compromise is considered a four-letter word. It's the equivalent of collaborating with the enemy.
Let me back you up for a minute to something you said, the average person in this economy doesn't care how Congress is running or sometimes even whether the government is running. What are the ramifications, though? I mean, other than Yosemite National Park being closed when, you know, you want to go on vacation, what's the real life impact of this?
Well, I mean, first of all, you're exactly right. The most immediate impact usually is on national parks because grass isn't allowed to grow when the government's closed. For the average person, they won't immediately notice. Unless you work for the government and are told not to go to work and you're not going to get paid, it'll take a couple of weeks before it starts to have an impact. And at that point, government contractors won't get paid, their invoices won't get processed. And in places where there's a big concentration of federal employees, the effect will be immediate. People who try to sell them cars will find that federal employees or their families don't want to buy these things because they don't know when they're going to get paid next. So it takes about 2 weeks.
Riddle me this. You've been around Washington for a long time. People tell you things. Do you see this cycle changing somehow as it gets worse and worse, which I know is an oxymoronic question?
Yeah, well, I wish I could tell you that I had a lot of hope that this was going to get better, but there's nothing on the horizon that shows that this hyper-partisanship is going to change anytime soon. And even if there's a Democratic wave, it's likely to produce a narrow Democratic majorities. And unless there's a crisis, this is just going to stay the same way. That is, you and I are going to be talking about continuing resolutions and government shutdowns for months to come this year and probably for years to come in the future.
Great. Just great. Stan Collender, he teaches public policy at Georgetown University. You can get him on Twitter, and I recommend this. You can follow him at The Budget Guy. Stan, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Kai.
On Wall Street today, a whole lot of meh, really. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So here's an interesting counterpoint to Congress not being able to figure out how to spend taxpayers' money. A government agency that says, look, thanks, but we've got all the money we need. Mick Mulvaney, the director of the Office of Management and Budget, also the director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, wrote a letter to Fed Chair Janet Yellen yesterday. The CFPB gets its funding from the Fed. And this letter, well, here's what it said.
This letter is to inform you that for second quarter of fiscal year 2018, the Bureau is requesting $0.
What's the problem?
Diane Katz is a senior fellow at the Conservative Heritage Foundation.
You know, if they don't need the money, you know, I don't see any reason that they should receive it.
Totally fair and fiscally responsible point. One is obliged to mention here, though, another point, that when Mulvaney was in Congress, his position was that the CFPB was, and this is a quote, a sick, sad joke. His letter yesterday, read obviously by one of our producers, went on.
Simply put, I have been assured that the funds currently in the Bureau fund are sufficient for the Bureau to carry out its statutory mandates for the next fiscal quarter while striving to be efficient, effective, and accountable.
I certainly understand the desire to protect taxpayer dollars.
Debbie Goldstein's the Executive Vice President at the Center for Responsible Lending.
But I think the mission of the CFPB is to protect the taxpayers, the American people, from lenders who target them for high cost and unaffordable loans. And the best way to save Americans millions of dollars is by preventing predatory lending, not by draining the CFPB's resources.
True to his budget hawk credentials, Mulvaney ended his letter by pointing out that the money he is not requesting, about $145 million or so, will go back to the Treasury and so help reduce the federal deficit. A quick follow to the Apple announcement yesterday that we told you about, that the most valuable company in the world is gonna, and this is their word, make a $350 billion contribution to the American economy by repatriating money it has held overseas for years and making a bunch of new manufacturing investments here. Good news, yes, and full stop. But as CEO Tim Cook told ABC News last night, let us not get carried away.
Let me be clear. There are large parts of this that are a result of the tax reform, and there's large parts of this that we would have done in any situation.
We called Apple, by the way. Mr. Cook has, as he knows, a standing invite to chat. Not available today. We have come to that once every 3 months point in the calendar where companies report quarterly profits, or losses. Goldman Sachs says it lost $1.9 billion American dollars in the 3 months ended New Year's Eve, the bank's first loss in 6 years. Lots going on in a company as sprawling as Goldman is, but one not-so-bright spot was the bank's trading desk. Yes, the markets are on a tear, but mostly in one direction, right? Marketplace's Mariel Segarra explains that traders profit from volatility, and that has been vanishingly low.
Every day, investors buy and sell stocks and bonds. Kevin Quigg at the asset management firm Exponential ETFs says those investors don't always agree about where the market's headed.
You have some people that think something is going to go up and some people that think something's going to go down. When those people meet in the market, you know, they're sort of collectively, their consensus opinion tends to move things up and down.
The more they disagree, the more prices change. That's volatility. But investors pretty much agree right now. The market is strong, so they're making fewer trades. Problem is, banks make money from trades. They act as middlemen. Patrick Kayser is a portfolio manager at Brandywine Global.
They generally charge a commission. The more stocks that are traded, the more commissions they earn.
Banks also make money when they match buyers with sellers. Kevin Quigg says they profit from any price difference.
So if you find someone willing to buy something for $10 and you match them with someone willing to sell it for $9.90, you keep the 10-cent difference.
More volatile prices mean more opportunity to profit. Linda Allen teaches finance at the Baruch College Zicklin School of Business.
The more volatile, the more the market moves, the greater the chance is that the market maker can exploit that, can buy lower and lower price and sell at a higher price.
Low volatility may hit banks on trading, but, say, the tax law could certainly make up for that. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
At some point within the next couple of weeks, maybe, because we've been waiting for this one for a while, but the White House says it is going to release its long-awaited infrastructure plan soon. The basic gist, to remind, is that the Trump administration is hoping to use something like $200 billion in federal money to get states, localities, and the private sector to chip in the rest, up to $1 trillion all told. That is, of course, a whole lot of money, which has people looking for an easier, perhaps less painful way to pay for new roads and bridges. For instance, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce says Congress ought to raise the federal gas tax by 25 cents a gallon and use that money. Marketplace's Rima Crace lays odds on that one.
The last time we saw a hike in the gas tax was back in 1993, 25 years ago.
The latest gas tax increase is old enough to drink, has graduated college, and has moved on with her life.
Richard Auchscher is a researcher at the Tax Policy Center. He says the tax has been stuck at about 18 cents per gallon, not enough to pay for our aging roads and bridges. And on top of that,
Americans are buying more fuel-efficient vehicles, so people are buying less gas, and they're paying less in gas tax because that rate has not kept up with inflation.
Under the chamber's proposal, the tax would increase by 5 cents every year for 5 years. That would raise about $375 billion over the next decade to fund infrastructure projects. That won't be easy to greenlight.
The politics on the gas tax are really difficult.
Adi Tomer studies infrastructure at the Brookings Institution.
Because every household gets hit, right? It's really tough justifying that folks are going to immediately feel it relative to, let's say, income taxes that you only tend to see, right, sometime between February and April when you file with the IRS.
Still, in recent years, about 25 states have raised their own gas tax. Gin Giuliano teaches transportation policy at the University of Southern California.
It's actually been quite bipartisan. And this is basically a response to the lack of federal funding to maintain the state highway systems.
The Trump administration has floated the idea of raising the federal gas tax, but history tells us it's unlikely to happen. I'm Rima Grace for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the local food system, the local food models have shifted so dramatically in just the past decade or two.
Food beyond just going to the grocery store. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 97 today, about 0.3%, closed at 26,071. The NASDAQ off 2 points, basically flat, 72.96. S&P 500 off 4, about 0.1%, 27.98. Talked about Goldman Sachs, gave back 1% today. Morgan Stanley beat expectations with its fourth quarter earnings, deposited 0.8%. Apple in the news today, as we've discussed, talking about how it's going to spend that money in the United States from the tax bill and other things. Apple, basically flat today. Investors said, meh, which is what I said a while ago. Bonds fell, yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.62%. Look out there, listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A year ago tomorrow, we were in Erie, Pennsylvania for a live show the day before Inauguration Day, looking at what people there in a county that had gone Obama, Obama, Trump in the past three presidential elections wanted out of the Trump administration. One of the things that put Erie on our radar was the way its economy has changed over the past couple of decades, specifically the people in that economy. Erie has lost a whole lot of its population as big manufacturers have gone elsewhere. But the city has welcomed immigrants and refugees in particular to fill that gap. We had Delana Jackson on the show that day. She is the director of the International Institute in Erie. It's a refugee resettlement organization. We have now called her back up 364 days later to see what's going on. Delana, good to have you back on.
Thanks for having me.
So when we did the live show from Erie a year ago, I went back and I listened before we came into the studio. You said you were hopeful that things would continue the way they had been going in refugee admissions to this country. How are you feeling now?
Well, I'm still going to go with hopeful because I think sometimes that's all you can do. But, you know, we definitely have been disappointed with what we've seen happening, especially the first quarter of our new year. So,
yeah. What are you hearing from your clients, from the folks that you assist, from the folks that you interact with on a day-to-day basis?
You know, I think they're trying to hold on to hope as well. I think they're disappointed as well. You know, we're talking about families and family reunification. So, you know, I think individuals are just a little, they're at a loss for what's going to happen and how their future looks as far as, you know, seeing certain family members. So,
When you go out and you're out getting a cup of coffee or you're, you know, driving to work, what does it look like in Erie nowadays? I mean, are you seeing for rent signs? Are you seeing help wanted signs? What are the sort of anecdotal indicators of sort of entry level economics there?
Yeah, I mean, so Erie as a community has stayed extremely supportive. You know, we have a new mayor that's, you know, intentionally naming refugees and immigrants as part of the solution in our Erie Refocus plan. So, you know, that part of it's very positive. But, you know, we have landlords with empty apartments, employers who are not able to fill positions efficiently and effectively. And, you know, as an agency, you know, we've definitely had to do some layoffs and restructuring in order to meet the new current reality.
You know, well, talk to me about that a little bit, right? Because if there's not if there aren't refugees coming to this country in the numbers you're accustomed to, you clearly don't have the staffing needs you used to.
Right, right. And, you know, what we've seen so far is, you know, we see, you know, we know there overall there would be a decrease, but, you know, we're really just hoping that the president's going to keep to the 45,000 that he committed to this year, and that we'll start to see some of those arrival trends pick up and change to meet that number. If we stay on projection, we won't.
Yeah, so here comes the touchier question. Why do you have hope that the president is going to stick to a commitment when he is known to change his mind on immigration virtually within a day?
Well, I think it's that change that I'll hope will. you know, and we have a strong network. You know, we have a lot of individuals really pulling for us and being vocal. You know, and as a country, it's what we do, and it's the right thing to do. So I'm hopeful that those voices will get through. So
we're at the year mark now in the Trump administration. There are three more years to go. What are those years going to hold for you?
A lot of uncertainty. A lot of uncertainty.
Delaina Jackson at the International Institute in Erie, Pennsylvania. Delaina, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you.
One of the big promises made by Donald Trump during the campaign was that he was going to bring manufacturing back to this country. We spent some time in Erie in the American Manufacturing Center. Kerry Quigley is the vice president of Sterling Technologies there in Lake City, Pennsylvania. Kerry, it's nice to have you back on.
Yeah, nice to talk to you again, Kai.
Let me know how business is. That's the standard first question. How you doing?
Business is okay. We're a little slow at the end of the calendar year for us, but it's picked up. Future looks pretty bright. We're pretty excited.
Last time we chatted, you were not thinking your future was so bright. What's changed?
You know, honestly, I think maybe hopefully some of these new tax laws are helping us, but I think the economy has really started to spark, and what we're starting to see is some of these companies are ready to start spending money on their business again, invest in their businesses, and start growing.
Yeah, so give me a sense of that, actually, right? So custom rotational molding, you guys do large plastic, like rain barrels and stuff like that. I was out there, and it's just a super cool operation. The market, the interest in those things has picked up. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, but also the custom contract manufacturing. So, you know, we'll take somebody from just a scratch where they've got an idea that they scratch on a napkin, and we'll manage the whole project and take them right through to warehousing the project, physically shipping the product for them. So what we've seen recently over the past maybe 4 to 6 months is we've really seen people calling in saying, hey, would you quote this project for me? Huh. So we're starting to see a lot more activity in the marketplace.
How's your labor force? I imagine if you're busier, you need more people. It's you guys are kind of a ways out of Erie downtown, right? Sort of in an area without much mass transit. How are you doing finding people to work?
Right. Yeah, that's our number one problem that we're all facing. You know, our industry is very physically laborious, and it's tough to begin with. And, you know, the unemployment rate's relatively low. That's a great thing. That's a sign that the current administration's doing some things right, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting because it's really impacted our ability to bring people in. Mm-hmm. You know, at this point, it's forced us to elevate our pay scale and start to, you know, seek a little higher-end worker. And that's okay. You know, we've certainly have no problem with that.
Huh. I don't want to get down too far into the tax law, but one of the things that was a key item for a lot of companies was this idea of being able to immediately expense your capital investments. Are you seeing that? Are you acting now on buying new big rotational molders and stuff?
Interesting question. Yes, we certainly are. We just we currently have a machine being installed as we speak, and we just ordered an even larger machine that's due to be delivered in April or March, brand new piece of equipment. Yeah, we're very excited about that.
How much does one of those big things run you?
They're $300,000 to $400,000 a piece. It's an investment in the business.
Right.
And I hope that what we're doing and what we're seeing is a pretty widespread thing across the country. I mean, Make America Great Again is all about manufacturing in our mind. Yeah. If we're a strong manufacturing country, we're putting a lot of people in jobs and we're keeping people busy and getting them paychecks.
What do you want in the next year then out of the White House and Washington?
More of the same. You know, it'd be great if we could see some things that make us a little bit more competitive with our neighbors from the north in Canada. They ship a lot of plastic into the States. And, you know, with our location being close to the border, it seems to impact our business. So we'd love to see if something there could take place. That would certainly help us. More motivation for the small business so that we can invest in our business and our employees. Any of those incentives that we could see would be very helpful.
Kerry Quigley, he's a vice president at Sterling Technologies. We got him in the plant there in Lake City, Pennsylvania. Kerry, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Kai. Have a great day.
Remember the now somewhat muffled boom in meal kit companies? Boxes of packaged ingredients showing up on your doorstep. All you gotta do is cook. Small farmers have been doing something similar for years now, and they are none too happy to see the prepackaged competition. From KQED, Sam Harnett has the story.
Paul Underhill built his Northern California farm on the CSA, or Community Supported Agriculture Model, which means he grows a lot of kale.
What are you watering?
It's kale transplants that are going to get planted tomorrow.
Underhill's customers pay him to deliver a box of produce every week. The cost can range anywhere from $18 to $38, depending on the size. There are no middlemen. The money goes straight to him.
It was basically like the 20th century farming equivalent of a funding website, you know, GoFundMe or something.
The community agricultural model came to the U.S. in the 1980s. It helped some small farmers survive as big industrial farms pushed down produce prices. Underhill and other farmers in the region say their CSA business grew steadily until the recession hit.
So back in 2008, we were delivering 1,300 to 1,400 boxes a week, and we're now doing somewhere between 750 and 850.
Underhill says farmers like him developed the whole straight-from-the-farm concept, which is now being undercut by the likes of Blue Apron, a meal kit company that has provided financial support to Marketplace in the past. Underhill says he can't afford to advertise like those big companies backed by venture capital.
At Blue Apron, we're building a better food system, where instead of paying for middlemen, we work directly with family farms.
Blue Apron declined to comment for this story. It had a rough year, losing some customers in a market that's becoming increasingly competitive. The meal kit company Sunbasket wrote in a statement that CSAs are another excellent way for savvy customers to gain access to quality produce, and we believe there's ample room in the marketplace for both. That marketplace is getting crowded, says Evan Wigg.
The new produce box schemes, they're really not the death of the CSA. They're just the newest iteration in a long, evolving trend.
Wigg founded the Farmers Guild, an advocacy group for local agriculture. He says CSAs used to be one of the only ways for urbanites to get things like heirloom kohlrabi or purple carrots. Today, in addition to the meal kits, there are also more farmers markets and organic produce is available at many grocery stores or Costco.
The local food system, the local food models have shifted so dramatically in just the past decade or two.
Wigg says customers now demand more convenience and control. CSAs often send produce that's in season, unlike the meal kits, which can tap different farms to give customers everything needed to make a specific meal.
We now live in a time when people can buy everything online, have almost everything delivered to their home.
Lorraine Walker runs Eatwell Farm, another Northern California CSA. She's trying to stay competitive by inviting customers to her farm to do things like pick strawberries and make pasta sauce.
Because that's the one thing nobody else can offer, is that true connection to the farm, to the soil, to the plants, and where your food comes from.
Back at Paul Underhill's farm, workers are wrapping pallets of vegetables with plastic, getting them ready to ship. Underhill is now selling more produce to restaurants and grocery stores. He's resisted selling to meal kit companies because he said they would cut into his profits.
It's very, it's... trying to think of a word other than depressing, but I mean, that's what it is.
With today's low produce prices and slim margins, Underhill says selling through a middleman isn't a long-term option for him. In Northern California, I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which revenge once again proves itself a dish best served cold. Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, 3 days out of office, went to Newark Airport the other day, presented himself at the VIP entrance, as he did for 8 years while in office, and was told to go stand in the regular security line with everybody else. Here is the revenge bit. Newark and the VIP entrance is run by the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which also operates the George Washington Bridge, where back in 2013, then-Governor Christie's aides decided it was time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's down about 97 points today, 0.3%. NASDAQ basically flat. S&P 500 off 4 points, about 0.1%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Tro are the Marketplace editing staff. John Gordon is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.